you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi there, I'm Janet. Welcome to The Good Place, the podcast.
Janet, what is a podcast?
It's like the radio, but there's no music, and literally anyone can do one at any moment about any subject. And there's a billion of them.
Sounds great. Hope you enjoy this week's episode.
Welcome to The Good Place, the podcast. I'm Mark Evan Jackson. I play Sean. In today's episode, we discuss the season one finale, chapter 13, Michael's Gambit. It includes guest cast Tia Sirkar, Bamba John Bamba, Luke Gulden, John Hartman, Jamie Williamson, Braxton Beckham, Joe Mandy, Monet Michael, and Josh Siegel. In this episode, while Eleanor, Tahani, Chidi, and Jason attempt to decide which two should go to the bad place, Eleanor makes the startling realization that they are already in the bad place. Before Michael is able to reboot their memories, Eleanor hides a note to herself in Janet's mouth. Eleanor is rebooted with a new soulmate and a somewhat altered afterlife. In flashbacks, we see the development of Michael's plan to torture the humans. Fans of The Good Place will remember this episode as the one in which not a bunch happens, and then we go home. My guest today is the director and writer of the episode, Mike Schur. Mike Schur, welcome. Everything is fine.
Oh, thank you. That's great to hear.
Where do we begin?
Well, you've already done podcasts on the first 12 episodes, right? I feel like you have begun already.
Just mean with this episode with you. I want to talk about the writer's room. I want to talk about the process. I want to talk about this episode. But one thing that came up very recently in our recording this is that you didn't have a season two pickup when we were shooting this episode. In fact, I don't think a frame of The Good Place had aired yet. Is that right?
That's true, yes. We shot the whole thing in the dark and did not... I mean, I had pitched the ending to NBC, so they sure. Felt like they didn't know what was happening. But yeah, we didn't know one way or the other whether we were coming back. So there was a chance that this episode was going to be the last thing that ever happened with the show. Which was kind of weirdly thrilling. Like, because if you could imagine, like, there's no good way for a TV show to get canceled, but this would have been a cool way for a TV show to get canceled. Like goodbye.
Complete destruction of all known reality.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, that happened, and then you just have to use your imagination to wonder what the rest of infinity is.
This episode begins with torture at its highest. Right? Like I think in the previous episode, we left them with Sean saying, Jason and Eleanor have been found to be property of the bad place. Mm-hmm. You owe us two people, you decide kind of
right.
thing. So that's talk about you had the torture matrix, the sort of diamond of who gets against whom, right?
Right. So the design of this, and this was an early decision. Like, and when I say early, I mean, I think around the time I was either writing the pilot or maybe we were shooting the pilot, it was sort of like, the end game has to get real crunchy, right? Mm-hmm. We have to devise a situation in which everyone is in one room being tortured. And the design of the show eventually became sort of like No Exit, the Jean-Paul Sartre play about three people who are in hell. Now they know they're in hell, right?
Right.
So it's a little different, but... I was like, the end of the season has to be basically all four of these people in a room. And so the design of this was everybody's in one room the whole time, and they're just, and it's just the dynamics. It's just person A, person B, person C, person D and they're all driving each other nuts. And so in order to accomplish that, we devised a scenario in which, and this is, you have to go back a couple episodes to see how the bricks were laid. We designed a scenario in which a person, ostensibly an impartial judge, Sean,
which was a lie,
says, I don't care. You guys decide, right? Mm-hmm. That had to, part of the torture, a huge part of the torture is it's up to them to figure out who's going to hell.
Sure.
And the reason that it's torture, obviously, is Chidi has tremendous guilt and a little bit of a martyr complex. And Eleanor has been on both sides of this. She's been like, I'm going to hide and pretend and everyone's got to help me because I'm awesome.
Right.
And she's gone all the way over the course of the season to like, you know what? I'm driving everybody crazy. I got to get out of here.
Right.
And then Jason's just a ding dong. And, and Tahani believes more than anything that she deserves to be in heaven. So you have like four very different points of view. Yeah. And the key was that, to me, the key was that it wasn't one of you has to go, right? If it had been one of you has to go, then it would have been very easy for Eleanor to do the right thing and say, I have to go because I'm not supposed to be here, right? Or for Chidi to say, no, I deserve this or whatever. But when it's two people, then it gets real interesting because then Sean and Michael and the other demons get to throw them the crazy curveball of, okay, well, if it's two people who have to go, so it should be Eleanor. The episode starts with Eleanor saying, come on, Jason and I are the ones who aren't supposed to be here. It's an easy call. Sorry, bud. We got to go.
He's reluctant because he is in love with Janet.
Yeah, and also because he's a ding-dong who doesn't want to go. Doesn't see the. He hasn't studied the ethics maybe as carefully as Eleanor has. But then the fun, the real fun in the act one break is Vicky, real Eleanor, coming in and throwing them the curveball of like, I'm going to go because Chidi doesn't love me, which is just quadruple torture for Chidi. So anyway, this is all a long way of saying that like we had to work backwards from this scenario many episodes into the past and lay down the foundations for these moments of like real Eleanor falling in love with Chidi and Chidi being conflicted about his feelings for Eleanor and Tahani and all that stuff. And it was all, the whole thing culminated in this episode. And that's why it was so fun to do.
It goes back, the laying of these bricks goes back even further than Sean, because I realized in the course of hosting this podcast that Trevor is a very good actor.
Yeah.
Because he brings real Eleanor, who he 100% knows is Vicky, off the train and off walks, you know, sweet Tia Sirkar, looking all doe-eyed, like, I don't know what's going on. So, this is really intricate. Why did you do this? Isn't a sitcom just easier than this?
I don't think so, actually.
Have you ever done anything so, like...
plot heavy? No, I haven't.
And cliffhangy and so intricate.
Here's a weird, like, I've been thinking about this recently in regards to my own, path or something. When I was, I took creative writing classes in college, and I wasn't great as a short story writer, but one kind of interesting note that I kept getting from my professors and from peer reviews of my work was I was more interested in plot than most people were. I think that's also partly, this is in like the late 90s or mid 90s, really. I think that like plot isn't really en vogue in the world of short fiction writing. I think that's
what are
not
the other categories?
Character. Like character and mise en scène and sort of like tone and mood and like and specificity of geographical location, you know, like is it the southeast and the kind of texture of the southeast, or is it the desert southwest, or is it like rural Wisconsin or whatever? And I'm from a very boring place. I'm from suburban Connecticut.
Okay.
That part of the world has been covered extensively by a number of fiction writers. John Updike alone has, and John Cheever and people like that. Like the white New England experience, we've got it. We're cool with that. The things that I happened to write were very like plot heavy because I just liked intricate storytelling. Mm-hmm. And so it was, and I didn't understand that wasn't like en vogue in that world. I didn't particularly care one way or the other because it wasn't going to be my future profession. But what I've realized is that like I, as a TV writer, I ended up on shows that weren't super plot heavy. They just weren't. Like The Office wasn't about plot. It was really about character and location and satire. It was, you know, corporate satire, private sector satire. Parks and Rec really wasn't about plot either. That was about the role of government in people's lives and about optimism versus pessimism and public service and all that sort of stuff. And so I think that what's happening with this show is like, I'm kind of for the first time indulging my own particular interest in, sure. in clock and sort of like mechanics and gears.
How's it going?
It's really fun. I mean, it's hard. It's very nerve-wracking because the possibility for making a mistake you can't correct is significant, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's why planning it in advance is so necessary. It's because you get locked into, and I think I talked the first time we did this about the pilot, I think I talked about the shield. And the shield was an incredible high wire act. There have been other shows that were like this. The Wire was an incredible high wire act, no pun intended. There have been shows like this that have relied very heavily on everything matters. Like every tiny shot, every plot development, every move on the chessboard matters.
Right.
And the problem living that way is like, it's just a constant, you know what it is? It's like in Roadrunner cartoons when the Wile E. Coyote builds a bridge by nailing a board to the edge of a cliff and then crawling out on it and nailing another board and then crawling out on that and nailing another board. Like yeah. That's what it feels like. Is like I don't know how this is being held up, but quick, hammer another board in before the whole thing collapses.
But there are millions of dollars and networks and really?
Yeah. I mean, look.
I mean, you're doing it. I'm not saying stop.
But
I'm saying
the thing is like that. Look, the chance for failure is roughly equal, no matter what kind of show you're doing. I think it's
okay.
Like it's about execution, and this is what Greg Daniels used to say on The Office: is like the idea isn't the thing; the execution is the thing, right? Like
right.
You can, no one. If you actually look at the history of television or any medium, it's like well, some of it is like well, that's such an amazing idea that like that, of course that was a success. Like, I don't know, like Memento or something.
Mm-hmm.
Memento's and for my money, still the best Christopher Nolan movie.
That's
and
a movie where someone tattoos their body because they have short-term memory loss. And it's sort of told in reverse.
He lives like moment to moment because he doesn't remember anything. And he's put all these reminders of who he is and what's going on in his life in photographs and notes and tattoos and stuff. And the movie's told backwards.
Right.
You learn the plot backwards. It's an incredible idea. But also, if it weren't executed properly, it would stink. Like anything would stink if you don't execute it properly. So I as far as like the money and the you know the budget of the show or the risk or whatever, it's like to me, it's the same. The risk is the same no matter what your idea is. It's about execution.
So Michael has a lot of tattoos in season three. Is that
you know what's funny is. So at the end of this, I'm actually amazingly going to tie this rambling discourse into what we're doing right now. Ready? Are you ready for this?
I don't know. You know we can't talk about season three.
Yes, I'm saying we're talking about episode 113, the
Correct.
End of season one. At the end of this episode, we had to have Eleanor send herself a message
right.
to the future that said what did give her a clue. That was how it ended, right? And so we talked about a lot of things. We said, okay, what if she writes a note to herself behind one of the clown paintings, right?
Mm-hmm.
Thinking like, oh, Michael references the clown paintings and how much they tortured her and stuff. And so she's like, oh, those clown paintings are going to be back. So I'll leave myself a note. Or what if she tattoos her, writes on her arm? What if she takes a Sharpie and writes, you know, whatever, don't trust Michael or find Chidi on her arm or whatever?
Sure.
We kept thinking about things like that. And then we were like, well, that's insane. These aren't tangible objects. We're in the afterlife. These are
virtual
objects
yeah.
that Michael, and also there's no guarantee. She has no guarantee that any of that stuff is going to be there again.
Right.
He might completely change everything. And are we really going to rest all of season two on the idea that Michael wouldn't check to see if she wrote on her own arm with a Sharpie? Like that's absurd, right?
Right.
So all of those we had, but Memento was a touchstone for us because we were thinking about the ways in which people who have problems with their memories being erased
yeah.
send messages to themselves. And in the end, we had planted this thing. Megan Amram had written a joke in episode 7, I think, which was that Janet, she was like, there's 25 versions of Janet. I can't eat anything. So when it's my birthday, I just shove a piece of cake where my mouth should be, right? That was a throwaway joke that Megan just wrote in that episode.
Really? Deliberate?
No, nothing.
Like, Colonel?
Nope. It was a total throwaway joke that I thought was hilarious and we left it in. And suddenly, And this is what happens very frequently with complicated shows like this. Suddenly that thing takes on a tremendous amount of importance we say, oh, this is how Eleanor gets this note to herself, is she puts this thing in Janet's mouth and figures even when Janet's rebooted, since she can't eat anything, it'll just still be there. Michael won't check her mouth to see if there's anything in there. And that's how she gets the note to herself. And then there you go. And that ends up becoming the entire hinge for season two.
I remember asking you on set during season two about the trolley problem, whether you had that in mind when you devised in the pilot that in the first season that the means of transportation was via train. And you're like, no, that was an accident.
Yep. Yeah, it really was. It was a total accident. Although I will say at some level, if you really want to get sort of like philosophical about things like this, the trolley problem...
Pass.
The reason we chose trains is because on a practical level, in terms of what you are able to show in TV with your budget and visual effects, and in a sort of, I don't know what you would call it, like a stylistic way, a train is like a cooler way for people to get around the afterlife than what? Than
beaming
teleportation
in and out.
Or something.
Yeah.
And it just seemed like the old timiness of a train made sense in some way. And the trolley problem is a sort of classic problem, in part because I think it has a kind of visual energy to it. Like, you can imagine being on a trolley ramp, like out of control trolley heading towards five people. There is some kismet there in terms of we chose trolleys in part because of their sort of classic design. There's some overlap, I would venture to say. But yeah, no, a lot of these things end up being, they seem like magic tricks, right?
Right.
They seem like this tiny detail in the middle of the year ends up becoming important at the end of the year. And sometimes it's very, very intentional. And sometimes it's like, oh, wait, we can just use that thing that we didn't know we were going to use.
I feel like 90% of this show is like really, like your logic is foolproof in things. There are questions that arise. You know, Michael and Sean have a conversation in Eleanor's bedroom. And Sean says, like, I hope your boss doesn't whatever.
Right.
Because you could get retired on, you know, burned on the surface of 1,000 suns or however it's framed. I'm talking about myself.
That's correct.
At that point. So it's coded.
Yeah.
And we have several evidences of that sort of thing. You know, like, Sean's cocoon, it isn't really real. I don't have that. When I am in the face of emotional, I'm saying I because I'm Sean. That's ridiculous. He can handle emotionally heated situations without cocooning. That was,
right.
I don't know, a story thing.
It's torture. He's okay. Torture. It's just a little bit of torture, right? It's like, right. We're not going to just make you make these arguments. I'm going to make, just for fun.
Flat-faced.
I'm going to make you do it in like the most annoying way possible. It's just, that was, our early discussion was like, there is no torture too small. That was a phrase that we used a lot.
Wow.
From Michael's point of view, and then by extension from Trevor's point of view or from Sean's point of view, there is no, like, at every moment, the point is to just drive them crazy.
No, you know? Stairs.
Yeah, just these little petty, stupid things that, like, that's part of the fun for them. Is like, we're going to get them anywhere we can. We're going to make their lives 1% worse whenever we can, because that's what we are here for. So that cocooning thing was, first of all, it's just a comedy device to get a series of monologues from all of our cast where they were trying to be as flat and emotionless as possible. But also, it's just like they're desperately trying to advocate for their friends and loved ones. And this, if they even put a tiny inflection in their voices, then they got to wait them out. So it was like that was no torture too small was like a good rule of thumb. That's why the stairs was so funny to me. It's like, just make Eleanor be a little bit annoyed every time she enters her own house.
There is established reality. There is truth in The Bad Place, The Good Place. I'm thinking of at the end of season two, I remember saying to you, after Janet lifts Sean up by the neck and throws him against the wall and then kicks him in the face, I said to you between takes, like, is this the end of Sean? And you were like, what do you mean? And I said, am I dead? And you were like, no, Janet can't kill demons.
Yeah.
Like, because you have this Dungeons and Dragons like hierarchy in your mind.
Yeah.
And then something happened that I won't get into in season three. It doesn't matter what it is. But I was like, you said, only one group of people can do this sort of thing. And then later you say another group does it. And I said, how? And you're like, I don't know. Like they hack it. Or, right, like that sort of thing. Can you tell the story that you told me about Phil and Chris and about nothing mattering?
Oh, yeah. So I don't want to say specifically who the person was, but Phil Lord and Chris Miller, who directed the Lego Movie, and they directed the pilot of Brooklyn Nine-Nine, which is how I came to really know them or work with them for the first time. They told me a story about working on a certain project, and the project was a very sort of mass market intended thing.
Yes.
And Phil and Chris were looking at the script, and they suddenly realized that there was a logic problem in the script.
A
very simple logic problem, like not and what I mean by that is not like, ooh, if you squint, this doesn't make sense. It was literally like in one scene, a guy is in Tunisia or something, and in the very next scene, he's walking down the street in Philadelphia. Right. And it was like, well, wait a second. Somehow this got all jumbled up, and we got to figure it out. So they sat down, and they were working through it, and they're like, man, we could explain this. We can move this here and do this over here. We could say, oh, we could say that he got the money from his friend, and then he got on a plane and whatever. And a person who was working on the movie came in, a powerful person,
right,
came in and said, what are you guys doing? And they said, hey, we just realized that in scene 7, he's in Tunisia, and in scene 8, he's in Philadelphia. And so we're trying to move this thing around and explain it this way. And the guy's response was, hey, guys, nobody cares.
Right.
And they were like, oh, okay. And they just kind of ignored it. And then in the movie, there is this giant, there is that logic problem exists, I believe. I actually don't remember. I shouldn't say that. In the script, as they shot it,
right,
the problem persisted. And the reason was because, and like, you could look at that story as a tale of Hollywood,
sure,
callousness or something, of the opposite of art, where it's like the specifics don't matter. People are morons. We have contempt for our audience. Or you could look at it, as I choose to, as a scenario in which it is very important to understand what you're making, right? Like what you are making with, let's say, Transformers 15.
Take it easy.
Is like, I can't believe I chose that franchise. Pirates of the Caribbean 17.
I'm fine with it.
Okay. What you're making when you're making that is very different than what you're making if you're making, you know, Manchester by the Sea. And so... That like the and it's not like it's, I don't say that just to be sort of like a silly. I say that because from the point of view of the writer or the creator or the actor or the producer or anything, what you are presenting and why you're presenting it matters moment to moment. Mm-hmm. And it matters in the macro and in the micro. And there is an argument to be made that if you're making Pirates of the Caribbean 17, that you are wasting your time and in fact you are harming your product by caring too much on meticulous plot mechanics. Because mm-hmm. that's not why people are going to see that movie. They're going to see it for spectacle and fun and adventure and,
right,
and a feeling and a vibe and a...
Octopus ghosts.
And yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so like you're actually doing a bad job, I think, if you are too nerdy about the way that character A gets to point B from point C. And so it was like, I think about that story a lot just because it feels like the message of that story to me is like, always think about what you're doing and why you're doing it and who you're doing it for, and make sure that you're properly doing it for those people in that scenario.
With the intricacy of the storytelling and the logic in the show and the nonlinear aspect in which the story is told, does that add days, weeks, months to the room process, the writer's room?
Yeah, although... I don't know. I mean, it's not like we don't know going into every year that that's a huge part of it,
sure,
right? It's like, I would say what it really does is it changes the allotment of time day to day. Like, it's just a thing that we are aware of that we have to account for while we're doing the normal work of breaking stories. So it doesn't, I don't know if it adds time. I would say it changes how we spend our time. Like, there's a lot right now. We're at the very, very end of breaking the third season, and we are breaking episodes literally like, we have everything written through 11 and,
okay,
and half of 12 is already written. And so, and we have the outline for 12 and 13 done, and we're just the only holdup in terms of executing the scripts is that we are looking at the plots of 8 through 13 holistically in one giant pile, because everything that happens starting in 8 directly affects everything that happens for the rest of the year. So we're just making sure that all of those big plot points in 8 are what we want to do for 9 and then 9 for 10 and so on and so on. So that's a new thing. Like, that didn't used to happen on other shows I've worked on because it wasn't, things weren't so tightly conceived of.
Right.
Although I will say that in certain seasons of certain shows, there have been at least chunks of episodes that I've worked on where it had the same feeling, where it was like, well, this has to happen here so that in the next episode this can happen and whatever. But in this case, it's really, we really have to approach it from an eagle eyes view.
Yeah.
Eagle's eye?
30,000 feet. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, an overview of what happens. It's so tempting to joke about season three and what might happen. But I'm so frightened of getting anywhere close to where you might be going.
That's like Jamila. Jamila right. doesn't like to, she runs and hides. She hides her, she puts her.
Speaking of which, like, did you do TCAs this year for season three?
No, you usually don't do TCAs for existing shows, yeah.
But I mean, you're being interviewed about season three and you can't say a thing, right?
No, I've gotten pretty good at the art of saying nothing, I would say. I was not great at it before. I like talking about the show. I like talking about anything I'm working on. It's fun. If anybody wants to talk to me about it, I'm happy to talk to them about it. So I've always enjoyed talking to any blogger or critic or fan or anybody who just is like, hey, this is interesting. Let's talk about it.
Sure.
In this case, I had to learn a new skill, which was to be able to talk about it without actually talking about it. And that's doable in part because I can always talk about Ted and Kristen and Manny and how good looking Manny Jacinto is and how sad it would have been if Will Harper had quit acting and how crazy it is that Jamil had never acted before. She right. showed up here and how amazing it is that Darcy Carden figured out how to play Janet when I didn't know how she should play Janet.
Mm-hmm.
There are things to talk about without the plot.
Okay.
It's less fun. Like, it's more fun to sit here with
you
now.
I mean, you have a delicious secret, right?
Yeah, exactly. And usually more than one. And so it's more fun to sit here and talk with you about episode 113 in retrospect and say, like, hey, wasn't that fun? And we can talk about it without ruining anybody's experience. Although, I imagine, do you think, here's a question for you.
Uh-oh.
Is anyone listening to this podcast who didn't watch the show?
I hope not. People have asked on Twitter whether it's important to have. And the answer is, of course, yes. That will improve the listening experience.
Yeah.
You can search for the episodes on NBC.com or the NBC app.
Oh, you have some nerve.
Guys.
If you go, it doesn't make sense for me to go.
Holy mother-forking shirtballs.
What?
Wow. Okay. Woo! Yo, Mikey, Sean, come on out.
Is everything okay?
Right as rain, Mikey, my boy. So, Chidi and I are gonna go to the bad place.
What?
Trust me, I've got this. That's our decision. Let's hit it.
Well, what about real Ellen?
No, it's me and Chidi. Call the train.
Point of order. I don't accept this offer. The real mistakes were Jason and Eleanor.
Gah. You said any two of us. It's me and Chidi. Let's do it to it.
Michael, I just found an obscure precedent in the rules that might just save everyone.
Buzz off, Bomba John. Don't need it.
Oh, okay.
Ready when you are, boss.
Eleanor, what's going on?
It took me a while to figure it out. But just now, as we were all fighting and yelling at each other and each one of us demanding we should go to the bad place, I thought to myself, man, this is torture. And then it hit me. They're never gonna call a train to take us to the bad place. They can't, because we're already here. This is the bad place.
Oh, man. I can't believe you figured it out. Oh, God. You ruined everything. You know that?
Holy mother-forking shirtballs. The full culmination of those swearing substitutes. Talk a little bit about Ted Danson and that sinister push in and laugh that we almost didn't shoot.
Yeah, so I've said this before in a couple places. Apologies if anyone's heard this before, but the script was written as Eleanor solves the puzzle. She challenges Michael. There's a long, very quiet pause in the sound mix. We dropped everything out except for the natural sound of Kristen slowly turning around and the floor creaking a little bit.
Is that right?
Yeah, we dropped out every single... There's no walla. There's no cricket sounds from the outside. There's none of the stuff. Usually there's a sort of bed of white noise kind of in any scene that just room tone and stuff. Right. And we dropped it all out. And it's really cool. It's a really weird, eerie moment because you're basically hearing nothing. You're hearing a soundstage, which is cool, which you don't often hear.
Wow.
So the way it was written was the camera crashes in on Michael. I imagined a scary Lost style sound effect, like the way that Lost episodes used to end with that weird shrieking orchestral like crescendo. And then he breaks in the script. And what he does is he becomes a petulant jerk teenager.
Right.
And he goes, "Ah, man, oh God, blah, Eleanor, you suck." And he stomps around. Right. So, and I thought that it would be really funny if what you saw was when the facade cracked and crumbled, that what you saw was just a jerk,
right.
just a total, the opposite of what we had come to believe Michael really is.
Right.
So we shot it a million times. And Ted did this amazing thing in the very first take, which is he ranted and raved and everyone stared at him with mouths agape. And then he collapsed down. I told him at the very end, just sit, collapse down in this chair.
Yeah.
So he collapsed in the chair and he looked over and there was this very small potted plant next to him.
Yeah.
And with an insouciant grin on his face, he reached out his index finger and just slowly pushed it off and it crashed to the ground. And then he upturned his hand like, "What do you think of that?"
Right.
And it was amazing.
Yeah.
And I was like, "Oh my God, this is great. This is going to work so well. I love it."
Right.
So we did it 6, 7, 8 more times. We got a bunch of more plants. We had him push the plant off every time because it was so funny.
Yeah.
But as we did it, it was like the end of it was great. The moment was still like, this is good, right? We were talking ourselves into it a little bit. It was like, this is okay.
It was there.
Yeah. It was like, yeah, it's going to work. Like, right. If you haven't seen this coming, it's going to be shocking. It's going to be fine. Yeah. But it was like 91% satisfying. And I was sort of talking it over with Ted, and you were there in a weird judge's robe looking like a real weenie.
Yeah.
And
a real weenie.
And I was like, I don't know, maybe it's this, maybe it's that. And he went, "Can I just try something? Let me just try something." And I was like, "Great, please. Yes, you're Ted Danson. Try whatever you want." And then the next take, we crashed in and he gave the giggle that is in the episode,
right,
which will stand the test of time as being one of the greatest, like, weird comedy / drama acting moments that I've ever personally witnessed.
For sure.
And it was a million times better. And then the problem became, how do you merge that giggle and the kind of like weird, sinister, almost like happy to have been caught Michael,
right,
with what we needed to get to, which was petulant, angry, and upset Michael? And the answer in network television is a commercial break.
Act break.
Yeah. We went to commercial. We had him giggle and laugh and say, "I can't believe you figured it out." And then we broke and we came back. Then he was annoyed and angry and petulant.
Do you double back and repeat a line? I've forgotten how exactly it's done.
We did. We overlapped a little bit. We used some audio from one take that wasn't natural audio, which was played on the faces of the people as they were staring and
right.
In shocked awe. So yeah, we finessed it a little bit, but basically we got the best of both worlds because we got the giggle,
yeah,
and then we got to get all the way to him shoving the plant off of the end table. So it was. I don't say this to be a suck up. That is Ted Danson being a genius. That is a thing that you could not write, really. You could write the stage direction he gives an evil giggle, but you,
right,
even if you did that, even if you were smart enough to do that, you would not technically be writing what he did, which is just inhabit 12 and a half episodes of a demon in a single moment, a demon being caught. It's just the most wonderful moment.
I think it's such a testament to the collaborative nature of this show because you and 12 or 14 writers spend months and months and months preparing this, getting it here, and in the last second, one person working on the show, it just happens to be America's sweetheart, national treasure, Ted Danson, but can go, do you mind if I try something? And it becomes the thing. It becomes iconic. It becomes forever.
Yeah. Well, that ought to be how it always is in every show.
I agree.
And you know, there are things that you can write that are better than an actor can extemporaneously do. And there are things that actors can extemporaneously do that are better than anything you can write. And if you decide to run your show to the exclusion of either of those categories,
right,
if you decide to run your show as like, this is just going to be actors just running around doing whatever they want to do.
Yeah.
Or if you say scripts are poems and they ought to be preserved in exactly word perfect, moment by moment, you know, sort of like dramatic reading with no chance for any improvement,
right,
then you're just cutting off your nose to spite your face. And I've never understood it there. Any show I have ever worked on, I can give you off the top of my head five times that are amazing, famous, wonderful moments in the show,
sure,
where the writing had very little to do with what happened. And I can also give you five moments where someone wrote something that is so perfect that the actors read it exactly the way it was intended to the letter.
Over and over.
And then
again,
that was the best it could ever be. So
sure,
like, you have to, I've never understood either extreme. Like, you have to create an environment where the best idea wins. And in this case, that was the best idea.
I'm smiling because I'm having a great memory of your telling the story of Parks and Recreation. I typed your symptoms into this thing here.
Yeah, exactly. Chris Pratt, I've talked about this so many times, it's nauseating, but Chris Pratt improvised what I think is the best joke we ever told on that show, which is Leslie Knope had the flu, and Pratt's character Andy was, in that episode, had temporarily taken over the job of being Ron Swanson's assistant, and he happened to be sitting at the desk when Ben Wyatt, Adam Scott, came in and saw that Leslie had the flu and took her to the hospital. And Norm Hiscock, who was on set for that episode, said to Pratt, hey, they're dragging Leslie right past you. As they go, just say whatever you want. Do whatever you want. Like, come on, say something on their way out. And what Pratt said was, and the point of the episode, by the way, was what an incompetent assistant he is, because he was the ding-dong of that show. And what he said was, as Leslie was being dragged to the hospital, Pratt said, Leslie, he pointed to the web browser, and he said, Leslie, I typed in your symptoms into the thing up here, and it says you might have network connectivity problems. That's a joke. That's the best joke we told on that show.
It was so
at least
good.
Tied for first. And, and you know, if we didn't have the spirit on that show of like, hey, best idea wins, do whatever you want, Chris Pratt, that wouldn't have aired. And it would have been so sad.
So sad. Eleanor finally has power in this moment.
Yeah.
After the Holy Mother forking shirt balls. First of all, an award-eligible realization.
Yeah.
That was incredible. She's got her hands behind her head. She's like, ugh. And then you see her go, wait a second, and connect dots, and you see these synapses fire.
Yeah.
And she turns. And then she's able to go, buzz off, Bombajan. Don't, like, Mikey, my boy. Like,
yeah,
all the power turns. And it's so delicious to watch her do that. And the four, Jason and Janet and Chidi and Tahani are all going like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Wait, why do I have to go? You know, and I feel as though Michael's sitting there with a quarterback's playlist on his arm going like, enter
yeah,
Vicky, enter, you know.
Yeah.
Like just calling, pulling all these strings and none of it works.
Yeah. We had it was a part of the main design of Eleanor Shellstrop from the beginning was she has an incredibly acute sense of when she is being taken advantage of or when someone's trying to take advantage of her.
Sure.
She has her antenna.
Eat my farts.
We talked about her antenna all the time. She has a really sensitive antenna for people because she's part of her backstory is her parents were nightmares and disasters. When she was 14, she moved out of her house and she lived on her own. She lied about her age to get a job, to support herself. She was uninterested in cliques in high school. It's not just a kind of like, yeah, she has walls up, she has a defense mechanism. It's that she has an incredibly sensitive antenna for when people are trying to screw her over or take advantage of her.
Thinking of the flashback about going to the movies. Do you want to go to the movies? Sure, I'll pay. Oh, so I owe you? Oh,
yeah.
You'll pay. What? So you,
so
get,
you
the
get the points,
yeah,
on your credit card? Oh. Yes, and it was always to the absolute detriment of her life. She was constantly assuming that everyone all the time was trying to screw her over, take advantage of her. And so we like that was the way that it unfolded, and the reason we did flashbacks like that is so that when she solved this particular puzzle about this particular guy in the ultimate case ever created of someone trying to take advantage of her or screw her over, that she would be incredibly satisfied. It's like she's a crossword puzzle enthusiast who just solved the most difficult crossword puzzle ever devised. And it was so satisfying to watch Kristen not just get that, but play that of like, oh, and that she's happy. She's like, this one's good. Like this guy really, but like it's the note that we talked about before we shot that scene was, this guy's good, but I'm better.
Right.
And that's what she played.
When you say that, you mean that's what you said to Kristen?
Yeah.
Like, have this in mind?
It was, this guy's good, but I'm better.
And because she doesn't just go, oh my gosh, this is the bad place. She calls his bluff and she goes, yeah, bring it.
Yeah.
Call the train, man.
Exactly. She toys with him a little bit.
Oh, wait, you can't?
Because she's 100% confident that she's right.
Yeah.
But the way she's going to prove it is she's going to get a tiny bit of revenge by torturing him for about 30 seconds. She gets to torture him by going like, no, come on, go ahead. Right. You said it was this. Go ahead. Let's go. Come on.
Oh, I mean, Sean's like, no, point of order. Yes. Like there are all these.
It's very fun to see Michael and Sean suddenly a little bit off their games. Like they're.
You directed me to, you're like, panic a little.
Yeah.
Like this needs to be like, no.
For the first time ever, these two, especially Sean.
Yeah.
But Sean and Michael being like, whoa, wait.
Hang on. Yeah. I don't accept this. right. Rules. Yeah. There are rules.
Yeah. It's such a good performance. It by Kristen, and it was the thing that everybody remembers is Michael's evil giggle, but Michael's evil giggle doesn't come out unless Kristen just absolutely nails that 90 seconds or 2 minutes of turning the tables. It's such a fun thing to watch.
And then as though things can't get worse, Michael says next time.
Yeah.
Oh, that's it. That's why I put you too close together. I'll do a slow burn next time. Yeah. And they're like, whoa, next time.
Yeah.
So it's going to happen again. The clock's ticking.
Yeah, that was a... There's a favorite personal move of mine is a self petard hoisting, let's call it, when someone is hoisted on his or her own petard.
What does that mean? I know that phrase.
It means that you are the victim of your own action, kind of. You are the one who designs your own prison cell or undoing. So Kristen Eleanor gives this monologue where she says, you know what, buddy? You thought we were going to torture each other. And, you were right. I'll give it up. You did a good job. But in the end, you blew it, because what you didn't count on is that the four of us would become friends and we'd get really close and we would help each other and support each other. And so the only thing you actually succeeded in doing was actually bringing us all together. And then very self gives him a very satisfied look. And he's like, oh, thank you. You just unlocked the key to the way I'm going to do this the next time, because it never occurred to her that that there could be a next time. So that's a nice little moment too, when Michael's like genuinely happy.
Right.
Now that's how the way Ted played it, which was wonderful, is like, just like, oh, this is so great. Oh, thank you. As if he needed babysitting and Eleanor came over to his house and said, like, hey, I can watch your kids while you run out.
Great.
He's just like, yeah. It's like, oh, God, this is so wonderful. Thank you so much. This is so great, because now I know how I can torture you for eternity.
We've talked in the first episode, you and I, about the video that Kristen shot of you telling the other four actors about the twist that we're talking about in this episode. Let's take a listen to that.
And is like, what is going on? And she goes, you know, it took me a long time to figure this out. But just now, when we were all fighting and screaming and yelling at each other about which one of us was going to get to go to the bad place, it finally hit me. They're never going to call a train to send us to the bad place. They can't, because we're already here. This is the bad place.
Oh!
And you all turn to Michael and he goes, oh, God damn it, Eleanor. Oh, you ruined everything. Oh, this was so much fun.
Oh my God.
And he collapses into a chair and that's the end of Act Two.
Oh my God.
It's a funny moment that I think must have been particularly interesting for Jamila and for Will, who thought their characters were, by right, in the good place.
That's right, yes.
And that's not only are they learning that this show that they're on is taking a massive, right turn or whatever, but they're like, oh no, I'm not so virtuous.
Yeah, well, it was fun as the season unfolded, their antenna went up a little bit, and Jamila was like, Dahani's kind of a handful, isn't she?
Oh, wow.
And I was like, yeah, she is. Like, you know, but that's part of the, you know, no one said that these people had to be perfect, right?
Sure.
I played it a little bit fast and loose.
You lied to them.
I lied to them. That's correct. That's another way to say that I played it fast and loose. but they were both aware that their characters had serious deficiencies or flaws.
Sure.
And so I think they were certainly shocked, and you can see it in their faces in that video that Kristen shot. But at the same time, you know, over the course of the season, there had been, by necessity, we had to lay in these moments where you saw the way that they were on Earth, and you saw that Tahani might have raised $60 billion for charity, but also she had a very screwed up priority. Her priorities were all out of whack. She did most of what she did to get revenge on her sister or impress her parents or whatever.
Right.
And so I think it was a shock because it was a shocking thing to tell them. But also, it was in retrospect, if you really thought back on what had happened, it was inevitable.
So Michael he reboots them.
Mm-hmm.
This is version 2, and things change in an effort to, I think, make it seem even more like The Good Place. Eleanor's soulmate is a buff, jacked mailman with his shirt off.
That's right.
And not only is everything fine, but now everything's great. Like, yeah. These are tiny little improvements that he was like, you know what I should do?
Yeah. Well, that was like, all right, Neighborhood 2.0. What does he do? You know, maybe fine isn't enough. Maybe we go great this time. And yes, Eleanor, he's obviously tinkered with the formula. He's separating the four humans. So we need a different soulmate for Eleanor. What's really going to make it appealing? What's really going to make her want to stay in The Good Place? Oh, if her...
Chris Baker.
Yeah.
Chris Baker.
He's from Teaneck, New Jersey.
Yeah.
He's a mailman.
Why Teaneck?
It's where Damon Lindelof is from.
Nice.
It was a little tip of the cap to Damon for helping me with the show. And because they're physically identical, Damon and Chris Baker. They look exactly alike, and their bodies are shaped the same way. That was a fun little, like, can you spot the difference? It's the thing in the dentist's office, right? In the magazine. It's like, can you spot the differences? There's a bunch of them. Obviously, it's pizza places now instead of frozen yogurt places.
Right.
It's everything is great. There's some differences in the way Michael's office is laid out. I think the painting behind his head is a slightly different piece of abstract art, and we just had fun with shifting everything around a tiny bit. The clown paintings in Eleanor's house are arranged differently. They're the same, but they're in a different order.
Wow.
It's a little tiny stuff like that. That's a little spot the difference game.
That suggests that Michael was like, it was probably the paintings. Probably the order.
part of that idea, was like, he says in this episode, when you see the flashback to him pitching the idea to Sean, he says, okay, this is a 15 million point plan, right? That's one of the jokes.
Right.
And if it's a 15 million point plan to start with, once it gets going, it becomes a 6 trillion point plan, right? It's
right.
As more and more things happen and variables occur and whatever. And so we were like, yeah, he's an immortal being with all the time in the world and unlimited resources. It's not like he has to have a crew come in and change this stuff. He just snaps his fingers. And because of that, and because he's immortal and omniscient within this world, there is no details too small. I would imagine not only did he think about the order of the clown paintings on the walls, but he thought about, like, was the grass in her patio, was that a quarter inch too long?
Wow.
Would she be less... happy if it were a quarter inch shorter? I mean, of course he did. That's the whole point of this.
Sure.
Is that there is no, he says it in the pilot. He says every ladybug, every blade of grass, like he's not lying when he says that. I have thought about everything. I have thought about the number of ladybugs that are floating around in the air and how that will affect you one way or the other. So yes, of course, everything is the color, the grain of the wood. Would it be more annoying for her if there were 6 more knots in the wood in her floor? Like,
no torture is too small.
No torture too small.
Wow. What are we missing? Like, what Teaneck, New Jersey's don't we know? Why U of M? Why Fibonacci?
U of M, my dad went to law school there, and I'm a Michigan fan. I was born in Ann Arbor.
Okay.
So, and specifically... I wanted, when the outfits turn stripey and crazy, I wanted that color scheme to be particularly jarring.
And
maize and blue is a particularly jarring. It's nice, one nice dark rich color and one light crazy color. I thought about, like, well, should it be, you know, should it be Harvard or Oxford or Cambridge, or should it be, you know, the University of Mumbai or something, right? But then I thought, well, no, I think it's an important part of, I mean, her name is Eleanor Shellstrap, which suggests that she's American, or it could have been American. And I thought, like, well, a state school is like a better, it doesn't suggest privilege in the way that like Oxford or Cambridge might have suggested privilege. And it was an important part of real Eleanor's backstory that everything about her was self-made, and she was the opposite of Kristen's Eleanor, right? She was a person who was abandoned in like a garbage dump by her parents, and then like her backstory is insane. Left in a fish tank. Yeah. She taught herself to speak English by watching Seinfeld and sort of stuff. So, I mean, yeah, in addition to No Torture Too Small, there's another aspect of the show, which is like all these decisions are vetted in this crazy intense way. There's very little, I'm not saying we always make the right decision, certainly, but every one of them, because of what we were talking about earlier, every one of them matters. And so it's like, we got to go over this stuff with a fine tooth comb to make sure there's at least an explanation for everything.
Are numbers significant in The Good Place? The neighborhood number stands out as low hanging fruit of a clue that even someone modicum Derek as me can see. But if we were to assemble all the times a number is mentioned, is that your address?
No, it's not. There are numbers are very mystical things, right?
Sure.
And people read into them. And speaking of Damon Lindelof on Lost, a large part of the mythology over the course of the many years of that show was the number sequence. It's the numbers that Hurley played to win the lottery. They're the same numbers that have to be entered into the computer by Desmond in the hatch to keep the whole world from exploding. Those numbers matter to that show. And so we kind of, in our version is slightly different, right? Our version is, well, this is not a mystical island where people are looking for significance. This is a torture chamber.
Mm-hmm.
And so what does a person who designs a torture chamber do? Oh, he makes you think that these numbers are significant.
Oh, no.
So neighborhood 12358W, 12358 is the beginning of the Fibonacci sequence, which is a conspiracy theorist dream. There's a lot of things in nature that follow the Fibonacci sequence. There's a lot of people who believe that it has mystical powers and abilities and this and that, whatever. That's why Michael chose it. He chose it because he wanted people within the neighborhood and also people at home watching the TV show to think like, ooh, what does that mean?
Right.
The same is true of the number 322. The number 322 pops up a lot. It's on the train cars and stuff.
Right.
322 is the skull and bones number. That is just so dumb.
Yale
secret society called the Skull and Bones that one of the people who works on our show may or may not have been in, and may or may not have told us that he was in it when you're not supposed to do that if you were in the Skull and Bones. But come on, for God's sake, it's a dumb secret society at a college. So we put the number 322 everywhere. You can find it constantly.
Wow.
And it's mostly it's a little tip of the cap to the idea that this is a torture chamber that is designed to make people go crazy. And we thought it would be fun if every time a number popped up, it were a number that would set off an alarm bell in a person who reads a lot of Reddit threads.
Have you ever talked about the genesis of your Twitter handle, Ken Tremendous? And if not, may I take a guess?
I would love you to take a guess. The truth is going to be very disappointing, but go ahead.
Is that true?
Yeah. But go ahead.
I don't know if I've not researched this at all, and I don't know if the timelines line up. Were you still writing on Saturday Night Live? Does it have anything to do with Saturday Night Live?
It does not.
Oh, okay.
what was your guess?
My guess was this, that it was an unused alt name for when Ludacris hosted and Kenan Thompson played Rickdiculous. I thought Ken Tremendous would be like, what's the worst version of this?
The sad thing is that I'm so old now that the actual genesis of it was probably 10 years before that happened or something. But weirdly, in the self-same creative writing classes that I mentioned earlier in college, I was writing a short story, and I was walking down the street from the dining hall to my dorm, and the name Ken Tremendous popped into my head, and I thought that would be a really funny name for a character in a short story. It doesn't work in the one I'm writing, but that's a really funny name for someone.
Yeah.
When I was in high school and college, I really loved Thomas Pynchon, the writer Thomas Pynchon, and almost all of Thomas Pynchon's character names are absurd.
Okay.
And goofy and jokey and silly, and And I think they probably came from just reading a lot of Thomas Pynchon novels. But that's it. I just thought that was a funny name, and I wrote it down in a notebook somewhere. And then when I wanted a sort of online persona, I was like, all right, well, Ken Tremendous. Oh, that's who I am. I'm Ken Tremendous.
The near rhyme of it is sort of satisfying. It's like imperfect.
It's a slant rhyme, but it's also like Ken is a pretty boring first name. Agreed. And then Tremendous is an absurd last name. That's what I think is funny about it. It's like Ken Tremendous is like a good juxtaposition of two things.
What was the show that you pitched to Ted Danson regarding a retired Supreme Court justice in Montana?
So my friend
Matt, and may I play him?
My friend Matt Murray had this idea for a pilot that was about a person who goes to work for a retired, like a, not a retired, a active like appeals court judge.
Oh, okay.
And who is going to be a sort of larger than life kind of, you know, like Montana or North Dakota or like out in the middle of nowhere. And he was in a politically very conservative person. Mm-hmm. So that was the original time that I met Ted, was pitching that, was being with my friend when he pitched that show. Matt writes on The Good Place.
He's right.
And then that didn't work out. But then while we were doing it, it was like, well, wait a second. Hang on a second. If he doesn't want to do this, there's this other thing that was in the early stages of creation. And so that was the origin of the idea to get Ted to play Michael.
Are you Michael? Are you Chidi?
You mean, who am I most like?
Yeah.
In terms of my role on the show or in real life?
You know that the show exists, your role on the show exists in real life.
Ooh, I don't understand what's happening right now.
Okay.
you mean who do I think I'm most like? Is that the question?
I suppose.
I had this theory. So when I was writing on The Office, there was only one character that I really identified with, and that was Jim Halpert. And a lot of Jim Halpert's like mannerisms and kind of like ways of talking, I feel like I locked into, it was very, very easy for me to write stories and lines and things for Jim Halpert.
Wow.
On Parks and Rec, it was Ben Wyatt. It was Adam Scott's character. Mm-hmm. Now, this is not surprising. Those two characters were roughly my age when I was writing for them, and they're kind of like slightly nerdy white guys. And so it's unsurprising that that would be who I most identify with. However, at some level, you are, especially when you create a show, you are everyone. Like you, the reason you created the characters are because there's some part of you that's imagining yourself as that person. So there's no one character I would say that I really feel like that person is me. Okay. On the show. I feel like there's a little, I'm a little everyone. And I think most of the writers would say the same thing. I would imagine is like, we all have a little cheaty in us, a little indecision and a little paranoia, or we all get a little freaked out about making choices. And I think there's a little bit of Eleanor in everyone, which is to say, everyone is a little bit worried all the time that there's someone who's trying to screw them over.
Yeah.
And there's a little bit of like the way that Tahani feels herself and is confident. Like you would like to believe that you have that a little bit. You'd also, I'm sure it's true that we all have a little bit of a complex about our parents and our siblings. And
oh, for sure.
There's a little bit of Jason just likes to kind of goof around and watch football. That's right there with him.
Bortles.
So yeah, I don't think there's one person that I most identify with. I'm not Michael. I know this is like a thing that like the character.
It's a little Fibonacci.
Yeah, it is. And in that case, it wasn't intended to be.
Okay. It's also a little archangel.
It's Fibonacci. Archangel. Yeah.
People want to sniff that and go, I get it.
I was with my wife on her for a 10-year anniversary. We went to Paris, which is where we had gone on our honeymoon, and we took a tour of Notre Dame, and over the cathedral at Notre Dame, there's a high relief of the archangel Michael weighing people's souls, because he was the one who weighed people's souls to say whether they went to heaven or hell. And I was in the middle of working on the pilot, and I was like, oh, that's the guy's name. He had been Ted in the script forever. I had just written Ted. And I was like, oh, wait, that's perfect. That's a perfect red herring, right? It's like you name him Michael because he is, over the course of the first season, going to appear to be the person who weighs Eleanor's soul to see if she gets in or out.
We've talked a little bit about the writer's room, gotten some fascinating insight. Josh and Dylan told us about the one keyboard, 14 monitors thing, which I witnessed. I was in the writer's room a week or so ago, and I saw you sit down. Do you type with just a few fingers?
I do.
I have always assumed that writers are able to mow down words with the speed of a live transcription.
I can type very, very quickly with the... I use...
Thumb, index, and middle, maybe.
I basically use two fingers on each hand and the thumb for the space bar. It's very weird. It's not recommended as a method.
It's super not ASDF, JKL, so.
No, and I never learned to touch type. I mean, again, this is like age. I think most kids, when I was in like elementary school, there was like, I'm thinking the last year of my elementary school, is like there's a new class and it's like keyboard, it's like typing,
right?
And it had just started. It was like 1989 or something, and it was like, oh, this is important, everyone needs to learn this.
Yeah.
And but it was too late. Like, kids now, I'm sure, are gonna, everyone can, well, they're not even in need to type. They're gonna just hook a suction cup up to their brains and like think things, and then the words will appear on the screen.
I pray to God it's magnetic and not suction cups.
I think it'll be suction cups.
Really?
Yeah, I'm going old school on this. I'm going steampunk. I think I missed being able to touch type by like 2 years. I think if I were 2 years younger, I would have learned it, but I just never did.
But so. Can you cook?
Oh God, no.
Oh, okay. You can't go like.
Oh wait, you meant you no? Don't I don't mean cook food. I thought I meant cook food.
Sorry, I'm from the jazz age. What I meant was, are you able
can you
to
cook
type quickly?
You meant, can daddy-o. You cook daddy-o? That's what you meant.
That's precisely it. Can you type quickly using merely your index, middle, and thumb?
I can type pretty quickly, however, very inaccurately sometimes. Sometimes I can cook, baby. Sometimes I just feel, you know what? In typing,
I'm 80.
In typing, it's the letters you don't type.
Oh, yeah. It's the words you don't write. Interesting.
But so, speed, but not accuracy. I do the thing where every capital letter, every word that's capitalized, the second letter of that word is always ends up capitalized, and it drives me up the wall.
How would you get to shift on with this?
I don't know what I'm doing.
Oh, my goodness.
Again, I'm waiting for the suction cup system, and then everything will be fine.
Mike, sure, what's good?
Oh, so we're doing this now.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So I didn't know you were going to ask me the first time. This time I prepared.
The first time you talked about givewell.org.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I have a list. Are you ready?
Oh, I Here do.
So the question is, what's good?
Oh, do you want me to set you up again?
No.
Be-be-ba-ba-boo. Mike, sure, what's good?
Oh, thanks for asking. In the category of peanut butter.
Oh.
Crunchy. In the category of berries. Blueberries. In the category of kinds of pizza?
Yes.
Onion.
Oh.
Yeah, you were surprised, weren't you?
Oh, my goodness.
I knew you were going to be.
No, the one and two were so mainstream.
I'm just telling you that, look, this is I'm reading an objective list. This isn't my list.
Oh.
This is objective. This is the universe just has announced
this. This is just truth.
Yeah, I'm a vessel for truth.
Empirical truth.
That's right. In the category of kinds of books, hardcover. that's a good kind of book. In the category of candy, peanut M&Ms.
Interesting.
In the category of breakfast foods.
Yes.
Scrambled eggs, whole wheat, butter toast, and coffee.
Okay.
In the category of sports, baseball.
Baseball, yeah, obviously.
In the category of charities that can help immigrant children who are currently being ripped away from their families at the border.
Yes.
Kids in Need of Defense, that's supportkind.org, SupportKind.org, and borderangels.org. Those are two excellent charities. I would encourage everyone to go because they're good. And finally, in the category of podcast hosts, Mark Evan Jackson.
That's ridiculous.
I was going to do people who can host a podcast based on an episode by episode podcast based on your TV show. But then I was like, well, that's too narrow a category. You're the only person in that category. So I'm just going to go podcast host.
You ruined the rest of the list by including that last item, including the part about helping charities that are helping children being ripped away from their immigrant parents.
Yes, kids, and one more time, Kids in Need of Defense, which is supportkind.org and borderangels.org. And there's other ones too. There's a Texas-based charity you can find. If you just Google them, you'll find a bunch of them. And I heartily encourage everyone to donate.
Nature abhors a vacuum. Do you think that by creating a show as good as The Good Place, you're responsible for all the mayhem we're experiencing?
It's a great question. Yeah.
Mike, sure. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
This has been The Good Place, the podcast. I'm Mark Evan Jackson. Now go do something good.
Hi there. The podcast is over. I think what I'm feeling is sadness.
Oh, don't worry, Janet. This podcast is the most perfectly engineered invention since the paperclip.
Fun fact, the man who invented the paperclip is in The Bad Place for tax evasion.
It's available on Apple Podcasts and all major podcasting platforms or wherever you get your podcasts.
Stop saying podcasts.
Hosted by Mark Evan Jackson.
Produced by Grant Rutter.
Written by Lizzie Pace.
Music composed by David Schwartz. Yay.